Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. Told by an Idiot have become one of the most lovably idiosyncratic theatre companies working in the UK. This year is their 21st anniversary, so I caught up with artistic directors Paul Hunter and Hayley Carmichael to hear about the company's beginnings, middles and, well, not endings, but future plans. So Paul, Hayley, welcome to Theatre Voice. Thought we'd start with the idea of 21 years. Did you ever expect the company to be going 21 years on?
I'd say no.
Me too. I've got to say, I think at that age, you're not, personally not really thinking much about the future. You're making what you're making at the time. So I don't think I would have thought about what 21 years of anything in terms of future. But no, if someone had asked me then, I probably wouldn't have thought we'd still be. I wouldn't have done. Mm. I wouldn't have done. I think that might be to do with theatre itself, being in the moment, and everything changes. I can see it now that it's 21 years, but I'm not sure really. I know everything that we did. Doesn't feel like 21 years actually. Apart from when I see that photograph of us on the verge of exploding, which we put up on the website.
Well, let's go right back to on the verge of exploding. Tell me how the company formed. What was the motivation?
I suppose the genesis behind it was just a meeting, really. I mean, Hayley and I met as students in 1986 on a two-year acting course, which was then at Middlesex Poly, and whilst there, we encountered a teacher called John Wright. And speaking personally, I mean, I had some notion of what I thought acting was, which was probably garnered from going to see plays at Birmingham Rep when I was like 14 and then Stratford. So my notion of theatre was, you know, fairly limited and fairly conventional. And then the course itself we did was fairly conventional, I think. But within that, John would have been maybe early 40s, mid 40s, and he also not only taught there, but he worked in the industry. He was co-founder of a company called Trestle, who were very, you know, were very active and quite a big company at the time in the late 80s. And his teaching, I suppose, completely certainly surprised me in the sense that he ran all the classes that were about improvisation, mask work, what was then called very old-fashionedly experimental theatre slot. And I think, for whatever reason, even though we were very different, Hayley and I, from how we came to be there, it clicked. His work clicked for both of us, really. So that was the going way back. That was the starting point. Yeah,
it's quite interesting that coming across a completely different style of theatre, because I mean, we all, I think, go through teenage years and have quite a set notion of what theatre is, and to suddenly discover this world beyond it that admits the oddity of that environment is quite a shock, I think, for people.
I think so. But I also think that's probably exactly what you're saying, Paul, whereas I didn't have any experience of theatre. I don't even remember what I thought theatre was. I'd been to Panto a couple of times, and that's all. And I'd not really thought about doing it, but I'd done a lot of gymnastics and sport and dance, and I suppose within that is the same thing of feeling like you've got a place to self-express and to create, and an element of performance, even in days of gymnastics, getting out and dancing around on the mat, you know, with everybody looking and hoping that they'll enjoy themselves. But I didn't have any notion of theatre, but I think that's probably true, what you've just said, in terms of what you just said, Paul, in terms of what you thought, maybe more what you thought of what you wanted for yourself as well. But I'm also thinking within that, I saw a bit of the BAFTAs last night, and there's a bit when Helen Mirren stood up and said, oh, we know, I had a great teacher. And suddenly I'm thinking, when you said that about John again, if John hadn't said that, ever said that to us in one of those classes at college, we probably wouldn't have maybe done any of this.
Oh, I think without a doubt. I think if we hadn't encountered John.
But even him saying about us two clicking and working well together, we had a good time, but for a teacher you admire and also are enjoying working with, who felt inspiring to say, oh, you two should work together. Yeah. It's quite a big deal. And
definitely, and I think I completely agree. I think that also the notion, which I, you know, never even crossed my mind, that he said, well, as actors, you can make it up, you can make the play up. And the notion that that was even a possibility, that people would do that. I agree with that. It was quite a bit extraordinary. And I think also, he also certainly introduced us to companies and stuff at the time which I'd never heard of, you know, taking us to the very early Complicito shows. His own work, Trestle's work, you know, there was a whole European area of work that he opened a whole door to, you know. So I definitely agree. I think if it wasn't for John, I don't know, maybe I'll still be acting, I've no idea, but it struck a chord in me actually when she said that about teaching, because I think it did come from that, definitely.
And it's reminding me, sorry, it's that feeling of like when we go into colleges or schools now, that you, in that way that I think is often the way actors, or maybe lots of artists think, is that sometimes you don't even know what you know, you just keep on doing it, but you, it's very hard to sort of define anything except for maybe performing it, but even then you're not thinking what it is that but actually thinking of John coming into us, and the fact he was that little go-between it being in an institution of learning and the outside world, professional, company, maker, you know, that made a real difference. I think I don't remember thinking that at the time about the other teachers not having that, but it makes me realise that that's what we are when we're going in now, and I do forget that, because sometimes you go in thinking, what can I possibly say that's going to...
And I think it was always, certainly looking back then, it was always exciting when you felt someone was working with you that very clearly was in the profession, do you know what I mean? It was, and I'm sure it's the same now when you're at drama school, if someone comes in and they are actively doing something, it feels like you have a connection, however tangentially, to what you're trying to do. And I think then over that course of that 2-year period, you know, completely honest, if you were sat here, I'd say, I mean, John's work did divide people, you know, certainly within our year, you know, from the start of the year when everyone had to go, it was quite quickly people finding excuses not to go. And I vividly remember walking up the hill to college, you know, when it's really snowing, and me and Hayley going up there and thinking, you had the perfect, I didn't know it at the time, you had the perfect mix for what you want theatre to be, which is a combination of excitement and fear, because you never knew what you're going to do or what you're going to be asked to do. And that certainly divided some people. But I think once we pursued that, his work, and then in the second year, as I say, we did the slightly quaintly old-fashioned term experimental theatre option, where he worked with us more intensively over a 3-month period. And we made a piece inspired by Commedia dell'arte, again, not knowing what Commedia dell'arte was. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, certainly personally, that was like someone, in terms of making theatre, playing theatre with an audience, that was like someone opening a door for me. And once you've done that, there's no way you can go, well, go back and just do that stuff where we ignore them and we learn our lines and we try to do it really well. There was no way I could sort of... That's nothing against that, and I still do that sort of theatre occasionally, but in terms of something that made you go, the possibilities of what it could be. And then I suppose, as Hayley said, he then encouraged us. And when it comes from a teacher you admire, as Hayley said, it means a lot. So I think my memory, you might correct me, but my memory said at the end, we were just finishing in 88, and he did a course, funny enough, downstairs where we are now, at the Raja Studios, the old drill hall, which was for professional actors. And then brilliantly, he asked a couple of us, maybe some more from our year, to come and join for a week. So it was the first time that, in a way, we'd been out of the context of the teaching. And then, as Hayley said, he said, I don't think you should do something together. But then, of course, the irony was, when we then sat down to try and think of something, we couldn't think of anything to do. So, but I think in retrospect, even though it took us sort of 4 or 5 years of going away and doing other things and getting equity cards and doing rep theatre.
We did do tiny little...
Yeah, fragments of things.
What was the first show on The Verge, but we did do sort of one-nighter or something at Chisenhale and get people together and do sort of one-off things, at least creating work, which again... Yeah, it was that thing of realising you felt more free and less waiting for the phone to ring, just by, even if it was for one night only, you know, getting together and creating work. Oh, you said something then, just then, that made me want to say something. Might need to have a pause there.
I also think in a sense, what happened by us not having an idea was, in the long term, a very good thing. And I'm not saying it's the only reason why we're turning 21, but I think a positive thing about that lack of, you could say, imagination, was that it made us go out and work with other people very, very early on. You know, yes, we kept coming back, but we, at that time, you had to get an equity card, and we were jobbing actors. And I think that interest outside of just ourselves, I would say, is one reason why we're still going, because we have consistently, over 21 years, gone away, come back, gone away. And I think to stay together solely, you look at the lifetime of a band. I mean, if you were, how long were the Beatles together? 7 years or something? You know, that sense of constantly being together. I'm amazed that some companies have managed to survive purely by doing that. Because I don't know how that's possible. Whereas we always had this sense of going away and coming back, I think.
I was saying at the beginning, I think because of that, knowing that we wanted to work together, I don't think we ever said for about 3 years, oh, we're a company, or, you know, we made a show, we asked John to direct it. A bit later, we asked him to direct the next one. And then a bit later, we asked him to direct the next one. And then did you direct the fourth or fifth?
No, I think we did four shows, which Hayley and I were in, which John directed. And then the fifth show, with the one about Lorca and Dahlia, I then directed. But, I mean, I think Hayley's right. When we went to Edinburgh on the verge of exploding, the single biggest thing, it was a show, but the single biggest thing about it was, and I think again it's remained really important to us, is whatever people thought of it or would make of it, no one had done it before. It did not exist. We'd not done a version of Hamlet. We'd not, you know, they could say, oh, it's not as good as that version. We had made it up. And I think that for me was a driving thing of going, whatever people say about it, we're going to go there, we're going to get to Edinburgh, and we're going to put a show on, which is ours, fundamentally ours. And we weren't the first people to do it, of course, a lot of people were doing it, but I think that side of it, again, side of it ignited a flame, because I think at that point, I just thought, well, at least if we get there, at least we can say we did it. If no one came, we did do it. Yeah. it did exist.
Hayley, what you were saying is about just a show and then a show and then a show. It's really interesting, because at 21, we can look back and we can go, these are the hallmarks of Told by an Idiot. These are the traits that make a Told by an Idiot show. And presumably, when you're starting out, you're discovering that as you go. And it's every show teaches you a little bit more about the things you like.
Oh, about things we like. Yes, I don't remember that. I could remember that each one was only worth making because we'd found a story or a theme or a relationship, actually, Dali Lorca and Bunuel and Lorca's death, but something which seemed so strong and touched us that you wanted to make a whole show out of it. So again, yeah, you're right. Now looking back, and I can see similarities. It's certainly big things, all the tragic stuff, you know, life and death and love and heartache, and but knowing that because we'd had our beginning with John, such a taste for humour and playfulness, I don't really now quite know why that was, but if I look back, they're big stories, I think, you know, not sort of about a family that live in a house and I'm being really naffy, but, you know, and have an argument and one of them walks out. That is also big, but it's the world we know and maybe touch on every day. We do have the other stuff every day, but we don't tend to always look at big tragic stories.
So I suppose a lot of the companies that you were perhaps being introduced to, a lot of the companies that were coming out of Le Coq around the same sort of time, a lot of their work was quite stylistic and technical, I guess. It sounds like you're saying that there was substance, the content came
first. Yes, I had forgotten about the Le Coq. You're absolutely right. I think we're friends of ours now, but I forget a lot of history. But and I think that's true. And a lot of people I know who did do Le Coq, a lot of them do criticise themselves and some of other companies for sort of presenting technique on stage. I think they must have been a bit like us and John, you know. You're excited by something, you probably want to keep on doing it, but ours was a bit different, a different introduction. I think maybe after time, lots of those companies then did find stories and have an appetite for more drama, but I think early on, yes, it was putting the skills themselves onto the stage. And I don't think I actually knew what skills we got. The training wasn't very long. The biggest thing was John and discovering a new world and a relationship with the audience and a love of narrative, you know, and we could got fired up by that. That's all I know. And I don't particularly think I thought I'd come out with any skills. I just came out knowing I loved doing it. Well, I think you must come out into the world slightly differently from the cock, with a kind of rigorous training in certain ways.
But it's interesting that because I think because of, going back to John again, because of that 2 year embracing it so wholeheartedly, and his teaching in many ways being influenced by Lecoq, Philippe Goddard, a lot of his European teachers, I think sometimes that sort of learning, or what you learn from that, is very hard to put your finger on. It's very, very, you can't go, I've now learned how to really grasp text, or how to, you know what I mean? It's much more elusive than that. And I think we both then, at times, obviously, immediately following that, worked with artists and people like Complicité and David Glass. And these. So along the way, I think you're refining some of the things that you have learned to begin with. But it's very hard to go, I know how to do that now.
How do you think the company's work has changed over 21 years? And what remains the same within that as well?
I would say the change is, and again, it's a conscious decision. I think the fact that we... Hayley and I in particular decided that we wanted change very early, which some would say was a bit naive perhaps. And when we did On the Verge of Exploding, it was a big hit in Edinburgh and then a big hit in London and then internationally in Romania and South Africa, and there was a big sort of desire for that show. And it was only when we were in, having spent 2 months in South Africa, that Hayley and I, you know, both felt the same thing at the same time, almost thought, well, it's been so amazing here to play at the Market Theatre and present it here. Should we finish it here? And I think John was quite amazed slash appalled by the notion that we were saying we don't want to do it anymore. And he was the one going, we're crazy, we have this show, you know, we should. So in some ways I think the notion of change was there right from the very beginning. So we thought, we've done that now. And I think that does maybe slightly set us apart from certain of our contemporaries or companies like us who would push a show for a long period of time, which makes all the reasons to do that make sense. But I think creatively, Hayley and I always thought, we want to do something different now, something new. So that even when we went to our second show, I'm So Big, inspired by Time of the Gypsies, a film by Costa Rica, it was a conscious choice to move away from what our first show was, which in some ways was quite a naive, comic, but tragic love story, and go to a much more brutal world. The world of Costa Rica is very poetic, but it's very brutal as well. That's why that clash is exciting. And we didn't adapt that film, but we thought, whatever this thing is, let's go to that sort of place. And of course, you alienate some people along the way, because people go, I want to see that thing. Why? Or they bring people and go, you should see them, they did that, and then they're watching something where it's very different. So I suppose about change has always been something we've really, really embraced, and I think over the years, both of us have felt any sense of repetition.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think probably we're sometimes maybe shoot ourselves in the foot, because we'll go, no, we're not going to do that because we've done that. That's, I don't know.
I think we probably felt that little thing inside that, because the temptation is there. And I think we decided to leave all our props and set and costume in South Africa on purpose, really, I think, because I think we could have possibly been persuaded, but I think we knew we didn't want to, so the sort of marked it by leaving everything behind, so we couldn't really do it easily. But I was thinking then also about words, and it's a bit of a parallel line, because I don't know what you'd say, Paul, but I think you were very happy with text and when you arrived at Middlesex, and had an appetite for words as well as stories and visuals and physical everything, language, but I didn't want to open my mouth. I found speaking very scary, the dancey sort of background. And thinking now about On the Verge and I'm So Big, possibly you haven't embraced me yet. I can't remember it so well in terms of text. I sort of ended up, I'm not sure really, but it was appropriate to the story, but also quite happily for me, a sort of inarticulate character. We had a sort of, now I think, a kind of gobbledygook, probably slightly offensive cod Spanish in On the Verge, but it didn't seem bad at the time. And we did actually, we had Roxy singing proper Spanish. but the same in I'm So Big, I was a sort of a young prostitute who got caught by these brothers and kept on a chain and used as a prostitute to make money. Again, very comic as well as dark. I just sort of stuttered and mumbled. I remember finding improvising, having to say anything really difficult. And as we have gone on as a company, I think we've been more rigorous with words than we were at the beginning. I really am proud of what we did at the beginning, and it was where we were at. And we said to ourselves, we want to be able to make a show that can go anywhere in the world and people will understand our story. And that meant that the words weren't what we're telling the story, but I think I was quite happy in that world as well. And I slowly have got an appetite and a love of words and poetry and how you can express yourself with words, not just physically. But I think also that's been the journey of us as a company as well.
I think so. But also that dynamic is interesting because first and foremost, even though the company obviously was Hayley, myself and John having stopped performing a long time ago, occasionally we tried to encourage him back, but he wasn't having any, a director-teacher relationship. But the fact that two of us out of those three were very much performers, and we are both still performers now, I think that kind of defined us as, if you had to say what's at the heart of Tom Willy, on one level, it would be about celebrating the performer or the actor. And I think that has kind of stayed central to what we do, whether we're doing an Ostrowski text at the Royal Exchange or whether we're making a wordless piece for four-year-olds at the Barbican. The notion of the actor's virtuosity, and it's different to technique because of course the technique is within that and hopefully contained within something that you're really trying to communicate, but to revel in that is something that I think has stayed very, very constant. But also, as Hayley said, you find a natural dynamic if you look at companies that are really performer based. And now if you look at early Complicité, and of course Simon became and is an extraordinary director and driving force, but the early shows was about a dynamic between four of them, Annabelle, Marcello, Joss and Simon, and it worked because they each had a very different dynamic. And I don't think we analysed it, and I don't think you should, but I think this dynamic that Hayley's talking about, naturally John on the outside, so he would provoke me into some verbal improvisation at the same time of provoking Hayley in a more physical way, but then the two things would obviously complement each other, come together to clash. But I certainly think the performer thing is stay constant, but I'd also agree with Hayley. I think our desire to certainly not to be trying to communicate through text, because I think that isn't what we're about, but to be as rigorous about how we create language as to how we create physical language has become something very, very crucial for us.
And I suppose within that, the increasing desire or willingness to engage with big stories, not just in terms of one thing and the horse you rode in on that you're still making up, but classics like Casanova, like Aladdin, like Beauty and the Beast, and then moving on to plays, these farces, the Phaedo coming up at the end of the year at Northampton.
I should immediately say the Phaedo, this comes back to us working outside, the Phaedo at the end of the year is not Tom Willy's show.
Okay.
That's fine. And I should say it's me directing outside. I think it's interesting.
There's blurred lines abound to happen.
I think they're less. It's interesting because when I do direct outside, which I do, I tend to direct in environments and with people who are very different to Tom Willy. Doing a Salisbury Playhouse show there or a Brecht at the Young Vic. I might be working with some actors who, of course, we would go, they're very good actors. But I think in this case, because the show in Northampton is being performed by three of Spy Monkey and me being from here, I think people are very quick to sometimes go, oh, it's a...
Maybe next time you've got the other monkey over with you.
Yes, because Petra's with us at the moment.
They both merge a bit, maybe, in that respect.
Probably merge. But I think it's interesting when you say about the sort of bigger texts and stuff that we've done recently. I think the same thing sort of applies. It's not that we have a different approach. Something we're doing this, we're still always looking for what is the really vibrant physical life of this play, the environment that these people inhabit. And I don't mean that psychologically, I mean it in a very, very credible way. We're also obviously drawn to texts that in some way carry big emotional things inside them, whilst at the same time allowing us to explode them in a really theatrical way. And sometimes the challenge of going maybe going to something where you more and more, I think, something we've become more interested in is the challenge of being drawn to something which you're not quite sure how to do.
Yes.
And I think a turning point, certainly I felt a turning point for us, was when Michael Grandage was at Sheffield Crucible, and he came to us because they got the rights to a Philip Pullman story, which was The Firemaker's Daughter. And because this is how theatre works, of course, they get someone to adapt that, a writer usually, and they then think, okay, we'll attach a director to it. And when they looked at this extraordinary fairy tale, they thought, oh, we haven't really got a director in mind. And then Michael luckily thought of us. But what we then, Hayley and I said when we read it, was this is brilliant, but we didn't know how to do it.
Mm.
I mean, the whole thing ended with a 15-minute firework competition on stage. There was, you know, you disappeared into a lake. There was a talking elephant. I mean, it was extraordinary in that sense. So luckily, we said to Michael, look, if you want us to do it, we'll do it, if you trust us. But we don't know how to do it. And I think sometimes that, for us, has been more interesting, is not knowing.
Do you then come up against the, I suppose, the institutions of theatre that have quite fixed ways of doing things, and you deliver your design at such and such a date, and you have your production meetings then, and it's all sort of set before you start rehearsing, and that doesn't quite seem like your style, I suppose, not knowing at the start of the process.
I think maybe I can remember Aladdin feeling a certain sort of clunkiness of the fact that we could see these, you were being told this date and that date for design. It didn't feel easy. It did feel a bit strange, but I think we just again just said, well, that's how it. We better come up with something, and whatever it is, we would then play with. I mean, I think as time's gone by, maybe with Naomi Wilkinson, who designed so many shows for us, there were little bits of pushing on deadlines. There were little pockets she'd find in a set design that she knew she could alter sort of later on if it served the story. And but I think again, it was just a bit of new language, you know, that there was these deadlines. Casanova, I remember feeling slightly the first time, because it was a very big show, probably the need to stick to all the deadlines that were presented to us, and yet the thing, we were sort of writing it on our feet, so it was devising. That one felt as if I felt we were slightly up against time and traditional sort of deadlines for the people to know what they were making, and but mostly
I think also I agree with Hayley, but I think something that we've managed luckily to achieve over the last sort of 8 or 9 years is the notion of what we call research and development. Mm. And I would say that is one of the most crucial things. If people say, well, what do you need to continue to make your work? We would say time, to be in a room with performers, writers, you know, at the earliest point. And I think where we've managed, I think, to maybe work within the restrictions of more, you know, building-based relationships, as we've had, is to ensure that we get the maximum amount of research and development time so that we can play around in advance of being in a rehearsal room. And, you know, some of the things, again, coming back to the Ostrovsky in Manchester, we had a week, you know, in London with our designer, with the performers, and some of the ideas, the notions that came out of that week completely influenced the playing style, the design, which we would not have had time for if we'd just gone, okay, design a set and here we go.
And I think that thing about the words earlier on, we may have naturally shifted towards feeling we needed to be more rigorous with our texts and not taking the first impro on stage, you know, and looking at the words again and rewriting. But I think, I don't know, it's really hand in hand with more time as well, that we had the time to revisit the scenes that we'd written in the first draft and rewrite them or cut things, you know. And so I think that thing of now managing to do several drafts in our way of writing, which is on our feet, it's still, you know, a few drafts down the line. The first draft doesn't go on stage.
That gives you a real density of thinking within pieces, like My Perfect Mind, like And the Horse You Rode In On, the big ideas that are being sort of layered up like pasta and lasagna that are just heaped on top of each other. I suppose that must come from it. But then the tension of that density with what you bring as performers, as comic actors, that levity, that for me is what really I find exciting about your work, that pull between very, very big ideas and very sort of light idiocy, I suppose.
But I suppose, you know, I mean, there's lots of, in different ways, maybe some of the influences that we've always been influenced by. Cinema is a massive influence on us and our work, sometimes in direct ways, sometimes, excuse me, tangentially. But I think there's, you know, certainly in film, there's been a very rich tradition going back a long way where perceived, idiocy or lunacy or whatever reveals quite profound things about the human condition or something. And I think I endlessly find that relationship really fascinating, because I'm not convinced that big ideas only have to, of course they can be communicated brilliantly through a very serious and rigorous approach to something, but I think what's exciting is when you're able to do it through something that's ludicrous, anarchic, and when the idea and the way you present it really connects, I think it can be really fascinating.
I think somewhere in there is why sometimes there might be room for misunderstandings. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate this, but somebody said something last night again on the television, I can't remember who they were talking about, maybe it was Peter Greenaway, about something about playing around or investigating the edges of something often reveals the centre, which made me think of Told by an Idiot. As in, lots of people put comedy sort of down on a lower level, the sort of mass entertainment, but not really, I don't know, not as highly, this is perverse, not skilled, but maybe it's a brain and body thing. Comedy often looks like it's physical and slapstick, as if it's not engaging your mind, and yet maybe, but it sort of is, but in a roundabout way, it touches heart and mind, but it's not where you're starting from. See, this is why I said I'm not sure I'm going to be able to articulate.
Kind of by stealth, it sneaks in and tickles your brain somehow.
But now I've lost the point of where I started. But I do think that somewhere in the explaining of what we are, if people can't immediately, if they are a sort of a head person and a word person, I think we look like silly people. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you get over that. I also think the very thing that I'm trying to articulate is hard, because there is something that about what we do, this is about not knowing, about not articulating, about not putting into boxes how you do something, and yet you've sort of got to talk to people. The word brand appears more and more, you know, and we are a company. Mm. The fact that we're sort of people that make work, and we have been making work for 21 years, like a lot of people want to define you, so I think you have to learn how to, which is good, to be provoked about what really makes you tick. At the same time, as a lot of it is the stuff that I don't mean in a superstitious way, like you don't want to sort of explain, but just it's quite
just is what it is. It came out of the rehearsal process a little bit mysteriously, and it just sort of happened.
And also some of those things, some of those things can also be about being open to a mistake. You know what I mean? An example in the show we're rehearsing at the moment, Never Try This at Home, Carl Gross, who's collaborating as a writer with us and works on Beauty and the Beast and Dark Philosophers with us, but he's not writing the play. This is again, when you're dealing with situations and relationships, the conventional thinking would be, you're working with Carl, therefore we'll commission Carl to write the script, which is your new play. And you go, no, Carl is another voice, brilliantly creative, but another voice within that room, and it's equal to anybody in that room. So Carl might write something which provokes a scene or a piece of dialogue, and he wrote something in which an actor said something wrong. So it's supposed to be, he got hold of his RAC club card, and the actor in the improv went, he got hold of his RSC club card, and the wheel went, maybe it should be the RSC. and suddenly this little improv opened up, and it was much more interesting and much funnier. But actually, it revealed suddenly in the mistake, the actor then was allowed to go closer to something about the character and the theme than he would have done if it was done purely by mistake. Now, Carl was up for it, and we all embraced the notion of the mistake. I mean, you can go that far sometimes.
The new show seems like it has exactly that thing that you were talking about, of this darkness, but this mania, I suppose, around it. Going into the world of Saturday morning kids television, going back to the 70s, tell us about Never Try This at Home.
Again, the starting point, a bit like lots of our shows, sometimes the starting point, certainly for some of our later work, has been a tiny moment. You know, we did a show, A Little Fantasy, and I think the starting point for that was a playing relationship between Hayley and Lisa Hammond. that they'd played not that much together. I think you'd taken over in Mexico for Shoot Me in the Heart, and but they clicked, and clearly it was a thing. And Hayley came and said, well, I'd like to do something with Lisa, and that was a brilliant to start with, was plenty, you know. And then Hayley had some ideas about some Rodin sculptures, and we fed some of things in, and it became this show. And I think there's been lots of occasions, I'd say, over the last 10 years where our starting point has been essentially quite small. Not emotionally, but the idea, like Edward having a stroke and not playing King Lear, we didn't have anything else. Mm. So likewise, we've never tried this at home. Roxana Silbert, who's artistic director of Birmingham Rep, asked me as a Brummy, was there anything that I wanted to do that was had a Birmingham connection? And I couldn't think of anything until I remembered going on Tiswas as an 8-year-old. And I sort of thought, well, maybe there's something in that. I had no idea again, and luckily they supported it, and we R&D'd it, and then it became this idiot project. Purely by chance, you know, we were looking at revelling in a certain anarchy that existed then in those, particularly Tiswas. Events then in the news sort of much later started to go, God, this is quite revealing at that period of time. And very quickly we go, well, we don't want to do that. It's not a piece about a certain way of sort of look at male behaviour or something. But we couldn't, it was kind of implicit in what we were doing anyway. And then we thought it'd be really great if we can make something whereby the whole of the show should feel like an episode of this Saturday morning TV thing. Everything we do should feel like it's in that. But at times they're dealing with really difficult issues, but it's still dealt with within the form of something that appears like a slapstick Saturday morning kids TV show. That for me felt very exciting. And sometimes, again, it's not just us, I think you can see brilliant moments where form and quite disturbing, profound content. I mean, the example of Oh What a Lovely War, which we've just revived, is an extraordinary example of the form. And you'd think initially, how can earth come? The Scottsboro Boys at the Young Vic is another example of taking this thing and then fusing it through a minstrel show. And I think theatrically, that's what theatre does brilliantly. Film less so, I would argue. But the idea of taking something where you think, really, you're going to push? So that's kind of what we're doing. I mean, it takes the form of, we created our own fictitious Saturday morning kids show, and we've created another fictitious TV show in contemporary times, in which a sort of slightly naff investigative journalist is reuniting some of these people from then. And it's weird because in a way the whole show is set within a world of TV, which for us would seem really strange. Why would we go to that? But how we, what it allows us to do is play with the notion of what is live, what isn't live. And in our work, which revels in being live, it's quite nice to play within a medium where actually it's not about that.
And I suppose it still has a, some sort of sense of, maybe not adaptation, but appropriation of cultural references, and that seems to run throughout, just a tickle of...
I suppose it goes right back to things like, you know, the first show was Tiny Fragment of Marquez, Costa Rica. There's always been, even if it's not an out, as you say, we haven't done that many out-and-out adaptations. I'm a Fool to Want You was inspired by the death of Boris Vian, and again, something of the European thing has always felt there. So yeah, I suppose it connects with that. But I suppose, who knows what, you know, it's, I think we're, for us, I suppose, turning 21, Hayley and I talked about this, you know, you might mark that by reviving something, and we are reviving, we're reviving My Perfect Mind later in the year, but you might go, what was one of our big hits that we could revive? And I don't think we've ever, over the years, I think when we were 10, people said, why don't you revive On the Verge of Exploding, you know? And we've got, as we've certainly got older, I've gone, I'm not doing that. But even putting younger performers in it feels odd, you know? So I suppose that for us, it feels brilliant that we turn 21 by something new rather than by looking back, in a word.
And also, I think you can't own what people think of you. So 21 years is our memories and things we made at the time, in the present moment. So we know them from how they were at the time. What they then become in other people's lives, or people who don't know those things. You know, people who said, you know, oh, I know Todd by Lydia, I've seen all their work, and they'll talk about the last three shows. That's fine. But in a way, I'd say My Perfect Mind, and I don't know about Too Clever, probably elements of it, they're sort of made up of all of you anyway. You wouldn't have made those shows if there hadn't been the 21-year journey of other shows and other experiences. I think it's that bit of like, whoever is it, Einstein says, you know, this thing that us human beings hold on to about past, present and future is our own imagination, you know, that we made up those definitions. We sort of here in the present, that's it. So doing a new show or bringing back Perfect Mind from last year is kind of now, and it's made up of all those years. So the idea of bringing something back to somehow show something of history, I think, is unnecessary, because this is all that matters, and it's full of everything from before.
Well, Paul Haley, thank you very much. Never Try This at Home starts at Birmingham Rep on the 27th of February and then tours around the UK.